Just Stories, The Kind That Never Grow Old, by Winfred Herbst, SDS. Published by the Society of the Divine Savior, St. Nazian, Wisconsin, 1929. Imprimatur, Paulus Petrus, Eps Sinus Virdis, Green Bay, Wisconsin, February 1, 1929. Good books are wise counselors. They point out the right way in the devious paths of life. Have we not often stood at the juncture of two roads, the one of righteousness and the other of unfaithfulness? And was it not then that some golden little book acted the part of an opportune adviser and directed us down the highway of truth? Is there one of us who can truthfully say that good books have not been his loyal and trustworthy helpers, his vigilant guardians in life's intricate ways? Introduction. This unpretentious little book of goodness stories, a companion volume to tell us another, must speak for itself. But should there be some who seek an explicit reason for its appearance, they may perhaps find it in the following rather droll exposition, so be it that they diligently seek. And since this book must speak for itself, the reader of these lines is kindly invited to imagine that it speaketh thus. One day, while walking through a garden, it so chanced that I saw a bee upon a blossom. I put out my hand and caught it. It stung me not. I wondered much and said, "Busy little bee, why dost thou not sting me?" Then did the busy little bee gently say, "Why should I sting thee, since thou art so near akin to me?" And I answered and said, "How is it that I am akin to thee, busy little bee?" And the bee said, "I fly from pretty flower to pretty flower, and I delve into the blossom's deepness, and I take therefrom the hidden sweetness, and I change it into sweeter honey within my body's neatness. And then do I place it into the honeycomb for others to eat. That is why I am like to thee, little book." Much more did I wonder at the bee's talk, and again did I say, "But how am I like to thee, busy little bee? Do I delve into the blossom's deepness? Do I take therefrom the hidden sweetness? Do I change it into sweeter honey within my body's neatness? And do I place it into the honeycomb for others to eat? My busy little bee, for you to tell me this is but meat." Then did the bee seem to smile upon me, and it buzzed and whispered into mine ear, and said, "Thou art the honeycomb, thou art the sweetness, and with thee there are all kinds of neatness. Listen, little book, thou didst fly from flower to flower and draw out booky sweetness, and thou didst change it into sweeter honey in words of booky neatness, and thou didst put that word-made honey into honeycombs of pages to be eaten by the loving minds of many springtime ages." Then did I smile a happy smile, and I petted the bee and said, "Wise little bee, how dost thou come to know it?" And the bee answered, "Oh, I saw thee at work amidst the blossoms here." Then I turned to look at the blossoms whose neatness had dropped into me, and while I was looking, away flew the bee. The Little Girl Who Was Not Afraid. It was during the fierce war between France and Russia. One evening, a detachment of Russian soldiers, scouts we might call them, I suppose, halted at the little village of Dijon in France. They straightway made it known that they would remain in the town during the night, and because there was no other building large enough to shelter them all, the officer in charge declared that the men would take up their quarters in the church. Wasn't that a dreadful thing to do? Of course it was. But in war all kinds of horrible things are done. The citizens of the place at once held a meeting to see what steps were to be taken. Nothing could be done. They would have to submit. It would not have been so bad if the Blessed Sacrament had not been in the church, and the parish priest was away. He had been called to a dying person far out in the country, and would not be able to get back before the next day. "Well," said one of the townspeople, "friends, we ourselves must remove the Blessed Sacrament from the tabernacle into the sacristy, where it will be safe and not exposed to desecration. Since the priest is not here, we may, and we even must, do what he would do. Who will carry the Blessed Sacrament into the sacristy?" They asked John, a youth who acted as sacristan. He shrank back. "No, I cannot. Oh, I dare not," he cried. Then each began to ask the other, but all gave the same answer. "No, I cannot. Oh, I dare not." They were afraid to go so near to Jesus. Then one of the townspeople, a very poor man, spoke. "I have a little girl, Marie. She is just 4 years old. She is an angel girlie. I will take her in my arms. Take her to the altar. Let her take the Blessed Sacrament in her innocent little hands. Then I will carry her into the sacristy. Thus shall it come to pass that only her pure hands shall touch the sacred vessel." To this they all agreed with joy. So the father walked up to the tabernacle with the little one in his arms. Her tiny hands clasped the ciborium containing the Blessed Sacrament. Lovingly she pressed it to her heart, while the proud parent pressed her to his and hastened into the sacristy with the precious burden. There were the sacred hosts, and they were put safely away. Now don't you really wish you were a Marie? How wonderful it must be to clasp Jesus himself into your heart and to whisper to his very self words of adoring love. Well, you can be a Marie, and more than a Marie, every single morning. Jesus comes right into your heart. You rest right in his arms when you receive Holy Communion. Marie was not a bit afraid to go so near to Jesus. The others were afraid. Marie was not. Why not? Because she was a good, innocent little darling. Be a Marie now, and come, innocent and unafraid, to rest a while each day on the bosom of him who said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." The New Children Innocents. You hear so much about crusades nowadays, children's crusades, mission crusades, all kinds of crusades. So you know, of course, just what a crusade is. For every time we think of modern crusades, our minds go back to the 7 or 9 great military expeditions undertaken by the Christians in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries for the recovery of the Holy Land from the Mohammedans. They are preeminently the crusades, from which others derive their name. Now, one of those holy crusades, the one I have in mind, put people who lived in Europe at that time to shame. It was the one of which Pope Innocent III exclaimed, "These children put us to shame. While we are buried in sleep, they are courageously flying to the defense of the Holy Land." Yes, that is just what they were doing, strange to relate. The children's crusade started in the village of Cloyes in France. Etienne, a simple shepherd boy, wrote to the king and declared that the Savior had bidden him, yes, Etienne, to preach a crusade among the children. It was in 1212. He preached as one inspired, and with such saintly fervor and natural eloquence, that as he passed from village to village, his army of children who were to fight the dreaded Turks grew and grew. Miracles, it is said, strengthened his influence. Like wildfire, the children's crusade spread throughout Europe. Not only boys and youths, but also tender maidens flocked to the standard of Etienne. The followers of the shepherd lad grew to a veritable army. On they went, with ever-increasing numbers, and when the astonished people asked them to whither they were going, they replied, "Toward God. We go to find the Holy Cross beyond the seas. The Most High has called us to Jerusalem to the relief of the Holy Land." What bravery! In spite of all opposition, Etienne finally reached Marseille with an enthusiastic army of several thousand little ones. There some merchants basely betrayed them. "For the love of God, we will transport you free of charge over the seas to the Holy Land." That is what they said, but their intention was to sell all the children to the Turks as slaves and thus enrich themselves. What a shameful thing to do! Surely such a crime must cry to heaven for vengeance. Oh yes, that strange army actually set sail in 7 large ships, but 2 of the vessels were wrecked near the Isle of St. Peter, and all on board were drowned. The other 5 ships were guided by the traitorous merchants to a place where the Sacrans were waiting, and the poor children were sold as slaves to those whom they had set out to conquer. Theirs was a fate worse than death. To mark the spots where the 2 ships had been wrecked, Pope Gregory IX later on erected a church on the shore of the Isle of St. Peter, in which he entombed those bodies of the little martyrs that had been thrown up by the sea, and he dedicated the church to the new children innocents. They had given their lives for the faith. Is not this a touching story? Surely Etienne, the shepherd boy leader, won a martyr's crown. And so did his followers. And it seems, yes, it seems that God used these little ones to put their elders to shame and to stir them up to generosity in responding to the appeals of the Holy Father. And also now children are God's crusaders in many a way. They are enthusiastically doing big things, those little people are. Take the missions, for instance. Why, boys and girls are giving just the fairest example to everybody. Honesty Rewarded. There she stood on the street, crying as though her heart were breaking, and vainly looking for something in the trampled snow. Margaret was her name. "Why are you crying so, my child?" asked a benevolent gentleman who happened to be passing by. "Oh," sobbed the girl, "my mother sent me to the store with 50 cents to buy groceries with, and I lost the money here in the snow, and I can't find it." "Well, now, that was careless enough of you," said the gentleman. "You ought to be more careful." "Yes, I know," said Margaret, "but there was a funeral starting from the house across the street, and I stopped to watch and forgot to hold the money tight, and it slipped from my hand into the snow, and, oh, sir, it's not because of the punishment I will receive, but because it will hurt Mother so. She must work so hard, and every penny means so much. Oh, I wish I had been more careful." And the poor girl began sobbing again. The gentleman was moved. Here was a girl who really thought much of her mother, and who looked at her carelessness in the right way. "Now, don't take it so hard, child," he said kindly. "Here's 50 cents. Just run along and buy the groceries with it, and be more careful in the future." With that, he passed on. He had only gone about 2 blocks when a breathless girl overtook him. It was Margaret. "Oh, sir," she began. Ah, could it be that she had been playing a dishonest trick on him, and that she was going to try it again? But no. "Oh, sir," said Margaret, "I found my money after you left, and here's your 50 cents back again, but I'm still so grateful to you. You were so good to me." "Well, well," said the benign gentleman in surprise, quite taken aback. "Little girl, you're the right kind. God love you. No, just keep the money, and here's another dollar for yourself. Such beautiful honesty is worth it, and unspeakably more." Thus was Margaret's honesty rewarded. If this virtue is so pleasing in the eyes of men, how precious it must be in the eyes of God. A Letter to Saint Joseph. Did this really happen? Yes. When? At the close of the 17th century. Where? At Lehmgrub, a suburb of Vienna, Austria. Now we have a start, so here's the lovely story. Paul Merton, the famous musician, was seated in his room with Josephine, his 16-year-old daughter. The room was poor and cold, and Mr. Merton was hungry, for those were hard times because of the wars with the Turks, and he was in bitter poverty, in actual destitution. "Father," said Josephine, "tomorrow I am going out to look for work. I am your daughter, and I must help you in your need, for both of us must live. Won't you please let me?"
"What?" exclaimed the musician. "Do you also want to leave me as all my friends have done? You are all I have, and do you too want to go?"
Paul Merton was bitter. He was even beginning to rebel against the benign providence of God.
"No, father," said the girl soothingly. "It's just for your sake, you know. I've written to relatives asking for help and have not yet received any answer."
"Very little assistance one may expect from such false friends," exclaimed Mr. Merton hotly. "They are all alike, faithless in time of need."
"Oh," cried Josephine suddenly, "I know what I'll do. I'll write a letter to dear Saint Joseph. Why didn't I think of it before? Why, he always helps, and in everything."
"Just as though that poor carpenter could alleviate our distress," said the father with a half-contemptuous smile. "Oh, but he will, and I'll write him a note at once and have my turtle dove carry it to him. Poor little dove, I could not even give it a piece of bread today." So Josephine wrote the following letter.
"Hail, O Saint Joseph, have pity on us in our great affliction. We have no work nor any means of sustenance. Pray our dear Lord that he may help me find work, for my father is suffering from hunger.
From thy faithful child, Josephine Merton." She fastened it round the neck of the little white turtle dove and let the poor creature fly out through the window. Then she waited. Half an hour passed. Suddenly there was a rap at the door. A stranger entered.
"Is this Mr. Paul Merton's home?" he asked.
"Yes," said Mr. Merton, in a short, irritated manner. "What do you want?"
"I have been sent by Saint Joseph, to whom I have a special devotion," said the visitor meekly. "He tells me that you are seeking employment. My name is Joseph Charles Hurt, a jeweler of this city, and it happens that I am in need of help. I have just joined the choir of the Carmelite Church here, and must now perfect myself by taking lessons. You are just the man who is able to give them to me. And, as I always pay in advance, here are 5 ducats. Can you begin the lesson tomorrow morning?"
Mr. Merton was too surprised for words. He merely nodded, thoroughly ashamed of his previous unchristian conduct.
"And," continued Mr. Hurt, "I have heard that your daughter here is very skillful with the needle. I would be pleased indeed if she would give her time to the high-class embroidery that I have on hand."
"Oh, I would so gladly do that," cried Josephine. "How good dear Saint Joseph is!"
"Yes, go to Saint Joseph always," said Mr. Hurt with a happy smile. "He is sure to help."
"How did it happen?"
"Why, the turtle dove, weak from long fasting and burdened with the letter, could not fly far. About a block away, it noticed an open window, and trustfully flew into the room and alighted on Mr. Hurt's desk. Imagine how surprised he must have been. He saw the letter round the pigeon's neck, removed it, broke the seal, and read the contents. It was just like a message from Saint Joseph himself, and he hastened to obey his glorious patron in the way we have seen above. How wonderful God's ways are! Dearest, never again say you do not see how God and his saints can do this or that for you. Just ask with childlike confidence. Ask and you shall receive.
Truly wonderful!
This would be a very long story were I to tell it as it might be told, but that is not what I am going to do. It happened in Poland. At Kiev, St. Hyacinth had built a large and beautiful church. One morning, however, while he was devoutly saying Mass in it, the news was hurriedly brought to him that the Tartars, then his people's greatest enemies, were at the gates, prepared for bloodshed, pillage, and plunder. Everybody else trembled with personal fear, but not so the saint. He feared only for the Blessed Sacrament, feared that it might be desecrated, insulted, in the profanation of the church which was sure to follow. Quietly opening the tabernacle, he took therefrom the ciborium containing the sacred hosts, and placed it under his garments on his breast. Then, turning to the frightened religious who were gathered around him, he said, "Fear not, trust in God, he will care for us. Just follow me." But as they were leaving the church, a mysterious voice called out insistently, "Hyacinth, Hyacinth!" The saint paused. The voice came from Our Lady's statue at the altar. "Hyacinth," the figure said reproachfully, "you take the Savior to safety and leave his blessed mother to the outrages of the heartless marauders?" "But, oh, mother," the saint protested, "I am not strong enough to carry thy statue, much as I would like to, for the statue was made of alabaster and was very heavy." "Ah," came the pleading reply, "if you only had more love for me and greater confidence in God, you would find it easy." "But I do love thee, and I do trust in God," said the saint. And going to the altar, he reverently took the miraculous statue into his arms. And just think of it, the image became to him as light and as easy to carry as a lovely flower. With the ciborium resting on his bosom and the statue in his arms, the saint hastened to leave the city, followed by his awed companions. And his trust was doubly rewarded. God struck the Tartars blind while he passed in safety. But a new obstacle presented itself. In order to reach Krakowia, they had to cross a river. When they reached its banks, they found no means of getting across. Full of confidence, however, in the power of the God he was carrying and in the intercession of his great mother, the saint made the sign of the cross over the river and set foot upon the water. Yes, upon the water, for he did not sink, but walked over its surface as over a street of glass. Not even the soles of his sandals were made wet. Amazed at this repetition of Peter walking on the waves, his companions followed, and they too reached the opposite shore dry-shod. Still more astonishing is an accompanying miracle that was related at St. Hyacinth canonization. The footprints that he made in crossing remained upon the surface a long time afterward, so that all could plainly see them. When the saint arrived in Krakowia, he placed the Blessed Sacrament in a church there with grateful adoration. The statue of Our Lady he put upon the Virgin's altar for the special veneration of the faithful. Is this not a wonderful story, full of wonders? And does it not make us proud of our great God and happy to be his devoted children? And does it not make us rejoice in having such a mother as the Mother of God and fill us with tender respect for her images and pictures that represent her? Of course it does. Well, let us remember that if we only had greater confidence in God and more love for Mary, we could... What could we do? Can you answer? What a reproach! Alexander the Great was once offering pagan sacrifice. A youthful courtier was waiting upon him, and while holding the thurible, a piece of burning charcoal fell upon his bare hand. But the lad did not make the slightest move. He let the charcoal burn him to the very bone. Why that? He was afraid to move, lest he caused distraction or displeasure to the emperor. What a reproach this is, not only for those who are serving at the altar of the true God, but for all who are present at divine services. How little careful they are not to disturb the priest at the altar, him who is placed above princes, honored above kings. Surely it is a more heroic thing to let a live coal burn its way into the flesh in order not to cause the least disturbance, than to avoid coming late for Mass, than to restrain that careless coughing, than to, but you know them all. Yet, even during the sacred moment of consecration, many do not seem to realize what is going on at the altar. They do not seem to care. What a reproach!
I'm not afraid. No girl was ever yet coaxed into a convent by being told that therein her path of life would always be strewn with roses. To be sure, there are many roses there, despite the fact that people in the world only too often paint dark and gloomy pictures of earth's fairest, happiest garden, the garden wherein souls bloom best for heaven. They forget that there are thorns in life's roses everywhere, and that also, and especially out in the world, there are cares and trials and troubles without number. And often there is not even time or disposition for sanctifying those adverse things. Indeed, love makes all things easy, particularly the love of God, which love finds freest scope within convent walls. And that reminds me of a girl who wished to become a Carmelite nun. She called at the convent to see the Reverend Mother and made known her heart's desire. Now, you know, in some religious orders the members lead a stricter, severer life than in others. So, for instance, the Carmelite order is known as being very austere. "My dear girl," said the Reverend Mother, "do you really think you could live the life we lead? It is a life of prayer and penance, you know." Then, to put the girl to a practical test, she took her through the convent. She showed her the plain cot in which she would have to sleep, the very common food she would have to eat, the hard benches on which she would have to kneel so often in the chapel. Was the little lady frightened? Oh, no. She looked and listened with calm serenity. When they returned to the spotless parlor after the inspection, the girl asked, "Reverend Mother, are there any crucifixes in the convent?" "Why, certainly," the nun answered, rather surprised. "There is a crucifix in every room that I showed you, and in all other rooms. Surely you must have seen them there." "Then, Reverend Mother, I am not afraid. If there's a crucifix in my cell, where you say my hard bed will be, and in the room where I take my simple meals, and in the rooms where I do my work in silence, and in the chapel where I kneel upon hard benches, I'm not at all afraid. The sight of Jesus crucified for me will enable me joyfully to endure those things that are so very much less than what he did for me. Please do let me be one of your community." The Reverend Mother was only too glad to take a girl who looked at the religious life in that true and noble way. That girl became a Carmelite nun and lived a holy and happy life to the edification of all who knew her. A thought now comes to me. If this girl could say, "I'm not afraid," with regard to a strict order of hidden prayer and penance, how much easier it is, so to speak, with reference to those less severe orders that do the work of Martha and are busy from morning to night tending to the Father's business, both praying and working for the salvation of souls. Afraid? Why, it would make the happy novice laugh. What Sister Told Me. To my knowledge, the story I am about to tell never appeared in print before. It was told me by Sister Mary, who used to relate it to the children under her care. And because it gives us such a lesson of respect and reverence for holy things,
I cannot help retelling it here, as well as I remember it. Jenny was a girl like so many others, alas. After she had left school, she began to think she was too smart to be good and pious. She just thought of having nice things and a good time, and she did only what she just had to for God. Poor Jenny. Yes, poor Jenny. Why, she had not even a rosary. And one day, when her anxious mother handed her a rosary that she had bought for her and said, "Please say it often, Jenny. You need Our Lady's care," the unhappy girl became angry and did a sad thing. "I don't need any old rosary or any such trash," she cried, and with her right hand she threw the blessed beads into the waste basket. Oh, how could she do such a thing? It makes one's heart ache. Some years passed. Jenny began to work in a factory. One day, in some inexplicable way, her right hand was caught in the machine she was operating and was torn and crushed in a dreadful way. She was taken to a hospital. The doctors found that her whole hand up to the wrist would have to be taken off, and so it was done. Jenny was crippled for life. Well, what of it? Why, that was the hand with which Jenny had thrown her rosary away in anger and contempt. Now she actually had to throw the hand itself away. "How I wish I could hold the beads in my right hand now," she said to Sister. "Oh, I feel that God has punished me thus for the dishonor I showed Our Lady's holy rosary." But that was the good God's way of bringing her back to goodness. She is very humble and devout today, and in her left hand there is often something that is beautiful to see in the hands of a Christian, the rosary. Such is the story that Sister told me. And now I am wondering how many right hands there are in the world that have times without number been used to offend God in even more dreadful ways than the way in which Jenny unhappily used hers. And I am wondering for how many people in the world it would not be better if they were sick or blind or deaf or lame or crippled. Such things are often a blessing in disguise. They draw us nearer to God. They make us think more of the happy land where sickness and sorrow shall be no more, nor any such thing.
His Throne. It's a beautiful legend, and one that has been inimitably told in verse. I am retelling it because we see that throne so often and everywhere, and yet forget what a glorious throne it is. When Jesus was a boy at Nazareth, a Roman lad once addressed him as he sat beside the well, all absorbed in thoughts of great events to be. Fidus was his name. "I seek Joseph the carpenter," he said. "From him I would learn the arts of his craft." "I can lead thee to him," answered the boy, "for I am called the son of Joseph." And he took him to his foster father. So Fidus remained and learned the carpenter's trade. Many the quiet walks of Roman youth had with the boy of Nazareth, who spoke to him in heavenly wise of a great king who was one day to be raised upon a throne so high that Jews and Romans and all the world might see. Then Fidus would exclaim in ardent longing, "Would that I, having become proficient in the school of Joseph, might build the exalted throne of that great king." Until one day the Christ, with outstretched arms that cast behind him the shadow of a cross, made him a promise. "Fidus," said he, "thou shalt build the throne of the great king in a future day, the throne from which he shall rule the nations. I promise thee." Years passed. Fidus had returned to a distant Jaffa, where he exercised his well-learnt trade with honor among the Romans. And then came a day when duty called him to Jerusalem. That day vast multitudes were in wild commotion in and around the Jewish capital, and the Roman heard dark, threatening cries of, "Crucify him," and "He maketh himself a king." What could it all mean? He recalled, he had never forgotten,
the promise of the prophet boy. Thou shalt build the throne, I promise thee. He was at the gates of Pilate's palace now. Fidus, exclaimed a Roman soldier who knew him and his skill in the craft of wood, thou art welcome. Even now I hear that three are to be crucified today, but two crosses are prepared. And Fidus made a cross, putting all his art into the making, for it behooved him to show his superior craftsmanship. And when it was finished, he gazed upon it with an artisan's honest pride. He went up a darkened hill outside the city that truly awful afternoon, and he heard a voice, the voice of him who had said, Thou shalt build the throne, I promise thee. And he gazed in astonishment upon the writhing figure fastened to the cross he had made. No, he could never mistake those features so fair. It was the Nazareth's boy, now grown to man's estate. So that was the throne. It was raised high, so that Jews and Romans and all the world might see, and his eyes were opened. Jesus is the great King, and from the throne of the cross he rules the hearts of men today.
The Little Saint and Holy Mass. Who is that beautiful boy that now watches the sheep for Felix when he goes to Mass? The neighbors asked each other in astonishment. They were surprised and mystified, and well they might have been, but I must tell you why. Saint Felix of Cantalicia, when still a boy of only 12 years, went to confession and Holy Communion very, very often. Moreover, he tried hard to go to Holy Mass every day. Of course, he knew that, first of all, we must do what we must do, and that we should not even go to daily Mass at the cost of neglecting serious duty. God wants us ever to do our duty. But where there's a will, there's a way, and Felix made it a point to find a way whenever it was a question of assisting at the adorable sacrifice. God was pleased with his good will, with his love for the Mass, and he was more pleased still when the saint, in perfect confidence, would say, Heavenly Father, I leave my flock under your care while I go to get the choice blessings which those receive who are at present at the holy sacrifice. Indeed, so pleased was our Father who is in heaven at the loving trust reposed in him by this saintly boy, that he would sometimes send an angel to watch the sheep while Felix was in the chapel hearing Mass. And that was the beautiful boy of whom the neighbors spoke in wonder. It was an angel. When they understood that God was showing his appreciation in that miraculous manner, they began to look upon Felix with reverential awe. They began to realize better what a great thing the devout hearing of Mass must be, and they began to imitate the pious shepherd boy. Yes, this little story teaches a big lesson, doesn't it? Oh, if we would but remember that in Holy Mass we offer God infinite adoration, infinite thanksgiving, infinite reparation. If we would but remember that herein we can most surely obtain all graces and blessings for ourselves, for our dear ones living and dead, for the poor souls in purgatory, then we would not be so very, very careless. Then we would never stay away just because we didn't feel like going. Then, too, we would give to others the salutary example of a living faith.
We will continue with more stories from the book Just Stories on the other side of the tape.